Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the important fronts in that war, of course, is Europe. It is a place which has been substantially overrun in recent years by people who seek very clearly to transform it, to turn it into something it hasn't been, and something that I think is probably going to be pretty unpleasant for the people most immediately involved, namely the native population of Europe, but also very problematic for the rest of us. Someone who has been keeping a very close eye on all of this and warning of it is our first guest. Her name is Ingrid Carlquist. She is a very accomplished investigative journalist. She is also the author of numerous books in Swedish. Alas, we've not yet gotten one translated, but we're looking forward to that, hopefully. But we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with her, especially in the aftermath of a recent election in Sweden that seems not to be giving rise to what would appear to be the desires of a great many Swedes for substantial redirection, course correction, you might say, towards the right. Ingrid Carlquist, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Tell us about what's happening in Sweden's electoral system and polity at the moment.
Thank you, Frank. I'm happy to be back. Well, you have to understand the election was a big disappointment for me. I had thought that the Swedes have had enough now, and that they would vote for the Sweden Democrats to make them the biggest party. They were not. They were only number three, just as before, but they gained about 5% or something like that. But, you know, what has happened since then is that first the so-called conservative bloc, they tried to form a government, but they still won't talk to the Sweden Democrats.
And just say a word, if you would, Ingrid, if I could interrupt you, just a bit more about the Swedish Democrats. When you say you thought that the Swedish people had had enough of what? And why would the Swedish Democrats have been corrective in that regard?
I mean that the Swedes have had enough of mass immigration, Islamization, and all, you know, the rape wave that we're experiencing, the murders, the robberies, everything. But I think that, you know, Swedes suffer from normalcy bias. You know, you just don't want to realize how bad it is. And, you know, you must also know that the establishment, the mainstream media, they have called the Sweden Democrats racist, xenophobe, Nazis, fascists, and all. So a lot of people are still very afraid. They don't have the guts, even though, you know, nobody knows who you are voting for. People are still afraid.
And is there reason to believe that the Swedish Democrats are any of those horrible things, or are they simply people who are trying to protect Sweden against, as you say, this transformative phenomenon of Sharia supremacism?
Yeah, and of course, when they started the party, there were a few crazy people. Some of them had some Nazi affiliation, I guess, but that's like 30 years ago. Come on. All the other Swedish parties, they were also Nazis during World War II, more or less. So, I mean, stop thinking about this. Stop talking about that. Let's see the facts for what they are now. Now, the Sweden Democrats, maybe they're not really a government party yet. They are still a bit, you know, unexperienced. But, I mean, they really want what's best for Sweden. They want to stop mass immigration. And they say, we have so many problems. Please let's put a hold on this and let's try to fix all the problems that we have had from this mass immigration.
Yeah. And so they were not spoken to by the Conservative Party, the party that was given the opportunity to put together a coalition, a ruling coalition. And that was simply because these so-called conservatives consider the the Swedish Democrats to be beyond the pale. Is that right? And the result was that they have now been forced to cede the right to form the next government to the leftists who have run this country into the ground on these very policies. Is that right?
It's really crazy. But we haven't seen the end yet. I mean, the Social Democrats that are now given the opportunity, they won't be able to form a government either. So, I mean, it might go back to the Conservatives, and maybe they will realize that we cannot let the Social Democrats ruin the country for 4 more years. Let's at least talk to the Sweden Democrats. Don't bring them into government. Just let them vote for your government, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm. And if that were, in fact, done. I mean, there will be presumably some influence on the part of the Sweden Democrats on government policy. Is there a substantial difference between the Conservatives and the Sweden Democrats on say, this issue, immigration issue?
Well, you know, there are 4 so-called conservative parties, and 2 of them, they are very much alike, the Sweden Democrats nowadays. But the other 2, the Liberals and the Center Party, they are more like left-wing parties. And I think that if they would go to the Social Democrats and form a government with them, that would be a good thing, because then they have shown their cards, they are really leftists, and that government will fall within a year or something like that. And then we might have a real conservative bloc with the Christian Democrats, the moderates, and the Sweden Democrats. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
And again, what I'm interested in, of course, is not simply the internal democratic process in Sweden, messy as it is at the moment, but what it means for Europe, how this plays out, and for that matter, I would argue for us in the West more generally. Ingrid Qvarnqvist, you've written extensively on the implications of this, as you put it, Islamicization. I think of it as sort of Sharia supremacism on the march. What would your thoughts be on that? What's at stake here for the rest of us in this jockeying for government control in Sweden?
What we saw was that now the Muslims are becoming so many, so they vote for other Muslims. We had one girl who came into the parliament. She's just like 27 years old. She's from Somalia. Nobody in her party, the Green Party, had ever heard of her. But she went into the parliament because she got all the votes from all the Somalis in her district. And that has happened in many municipalities too. And that is what I think will happen in Europe if we don't stop this, because we do not think like a tribe, but they have this tribal thinking. They don't know what she's going to do in parliament. They just vote for her because she...
A member of the tribe.
Yeah. And that, I think, will be a great problem within a couple of years. We've seen it very clearly now, and I think that you will see it in France and Germany and all over. So we really have to see to that the Muslims don't grow. They cannot become more. They should become less.
Well, and I think you would agree with me that the issue is not whether they're Muslim or not. It's the kinds of policies that they're going to be insisting upon. We'll be watching what happens in Sweden. Thank you for your reporting on it for us, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. The great Ingrid Qvarnqvist. Keep up the good work, my dear. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll go inside the ring right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit inside the ring, a guided tour provided to us by the author of a prize-winning column of that name at the Washington Times, also the senior editor of an indispensable online resource, the Washington Free Beacon. His name, of course, is Bill Gertz. He is also the author of 7, count them, 7 best-selling books, including most recently iWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, Bill, as often is the case, I want to pick your brains about a number of things, all of which have in common communist China. And I'd like to start with a report that you had this week of a further warning by the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, I believe, as he was headed to Vietnam, a country which has had its problems with the Chinese over the years, concerning what the Chinese are continuing to do to militarize the islands they have created and claimed all over the South China Sea. Talk about what he's forecasting and the implications of that.
Well, sure. First, despite the mainstream media's focus on other issues, there's plenty of news related to China that is not getting reported in other outlets, but I've certainly focused on it. And Mattis, when he was traveling to Vietnam, where, again, he's trying to develop an anti-China alliance among Southeast Asian nations. He's going to be meeting with defense ministers of the ASEAN nations in that region. But he voiced some fresh concerns about what he said was continued militarization of disputed islands. And he upped the rhetoric a little bit, which, again, anybody that's been in Washington knows that this is a serious issue. And instead of just saying we're concerned, he said we're very concerned about this continued militarization. And the reason is that the Chinese, as I've reported back in June, are deploying advanced anti-ship missiles and advanced air defense missiles. And these are going to threaten our U.S. Warships and our U.S. aircraft that are continuing to sail throughout the South China Sea, despite protestations from the Chinese, as well as flying surveillance missions over the sea as well.
Yeah, and speaking of those surveillance missions, Bill, one of the things that is worrying about what the Chinese are up to, it's probably a little less glaring problem than putting in place large missile systems and so on. But talk a little bit about some of the reporting you've done on the Chinese use of lasers against our pilots in that area.
Yeah, there have been reports and actual cases where the Chinese are using lasers to damage the eyes of our air crews that have been flying through there. The first most recent case was from a surveillance aircraft that was flying near the Horn of Africa, and it was going by the Djibouti base set up by the Chinese military. It's their first overseas military base, and again, the Pentagon has not been forthcoming in really pushing back against this. So there was an incident of a laser against our air crews in the Horn of Africa, and a second report of laser use against air crews over the South China Sea. This is an extremely serious issue, and I feel that the administration has not done enough to push back. When I asked the Pentagon about it, they pass the buck and say, oh, this is a matter the State Department's dealing with. What that means is that they're issuing a demarche, which was once famously called a demarche mellow. In other words, a protest note that really doesn't bring results.
And is there any information about what is the status of the pilots who've been assaulted in this way?
Nope. The Pentagon has closed ranks. Again, they're trying to defend and protect their military-to-military relationship with the Chinese, which is in a shambles, basically. But there are still a lot of pro-China officials in the bureaucracy, both in the Pentagon and the State Department, who have vested interests in trying to keep the military relationship going with China, even though it has proved to be feckless and actually damaging to national security when you consider that we've lost valuable information during Chinese visits here. But the Chinese, they basically cut off military relations a couple of weeks ago after the State Department sanctioned a very senior general in the People's Liberation Army who was in charge of arms sales, buying weapons from Russia. So they actually used a Russia sanctions law that Congress passed to try and punish Russia for its Crimea invasion to sanction the Chinese. And the Chinese went ballistic, and they cut off talks, they blocked a warship visit, and then they stepped up a rather dangerous warship interdiction in the South China Sea just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, just a closing thought on that. I mean, I get it that people, you know, are determined to try to protect their contacts with the Chinese. But last time I checked, military personnel typically try to protect their own. And this is outrageous that this is not getting the attention that it deserves. Bill, speaking of those dangerous exercises and or interdiction operations, I should say, by the Chinese in the South China Sea, and National Security Advisor John Bolton put a pretty profoundly challenging marker down with respect to the Chinese in this regard. Tell us a little bit about his warnings to the Chinese about this kind of aggression.
Yeah, Bolton was very strong in issuing a very blunt warning to the Chinese. And this was related to an incident that occurred between the U.S. warship, the USS Decatur, which is a guided missile destroyer, and a Chinese warship. And the Chinese warship near the Spratly Islands came very close to colliding with the warship.
Like 45 feet close, as I understand.
Yeah, well, the Pentagon insists it was 45 yards, but we published a photo which shows that it was much closer than 45 yards. Anyway, this prompted Bolton to talk about this naval harassment by the Chinese, and he said, "We will not tolerate threats to American service members. We're determined to keep international sea lanes open. This is something the Chinese need to understand. Their behavior has been unnecessarily provocative for far too long." And then he went on to say that U.S. commanders have all the authority they need. So again, this is a real warning shot across the bow of the Chinese by telling them if something like that happens, they can expect a forceful response from the U.S. military.
Well, God bless John Bolton, and I hope this admonition is being heard loud and clear in Beijing. Bill, let me ask you about one other thing that you've reported on in this sort of similar vein. The Chinese are evidently pursuing very aggressively not only the exploration and evolution of artificial intelligence, but its weaponization as well. There's a lot of concern in certain circles that we may start seeing autonomous weapon systems, that is to say, weapon systems that don't have a man in the loop, at least being used against us. What do we know about that from the Defense Intelligence Agency and other sources of yours, and what are its implications as you see it?
Well, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Ashley, gave a speech recently where he said China is really moving out in a very aggressive way to develop artificial intelligence. They've made it one of their highest priorities that by 2025, they want to be the world leader in artificial intelligence. Now, that would be fine if they were using it for civilian and peaceful purposes, but General Ashley said that the problem is that they're using this for developing asymmetric warfare capabilities. Again, there are all types of ways that artificial intelligence can be used, but from my research, it involves the use of autonomous weapon systems, specifically aircraft, as well as undersea weapons. The Chinese are also developing land autonomous weapons. And again, these are robot arms that are capable of making decisions on what to attack, when to attack, and how to attack it. So, again, it creates some real dangers about the future of conflict, because something like that could quickly escalate beyond a conventional conflict into a nuclear conflict.
It could indeed. These are dangerous times and dangerous adversaries that are emerging. Amazingly, Bill Gertz, you've also reported on help that the Chinese are getting from an American company that all of us are familiar with, Google. What are the folks at Google doing? And bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that Google has had employees say they're not going to participate in helping the United States military, but they certainly seem to be helping the Chinese with at least their domestic control in the tyranny that they impose upon their people, and that has obvious implications for the kind of threat that they pose to us as well. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, please, Bill Gertz.
Yeah, some new details recently emerged about how Google is secretly working with the Chinese government to create a special search engine that will allow China to censor internet searches. This is basically this tech giant Google supporting Chinese repression. The speech was done in July by Ben Gomez.
He's a Google employee, right?
He's the head of their search engine development. And he, in the speech, he just blatantly said, oh, this is the next market. We can learn from the Chinese. And it's really scandalous when you think about that Google refuses to help the U.S. military on this, but is helping the repressive communist regime in China. And, of course, a lot of people are speaking out against that. Vice President Pence, in his recent speech, said called on Google to immediately end its work on this search engine, as well as human rights groups and members of Congress are also speaking out against it.
Yeah. Bill, so much to talk about. I appreciate your work, particularly with respect to the China threat. Thank you for joining us each week and for sharing so many of these important stories that you're covering. Keep up the good work, my friend. I know you will. Come back to us again next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by an old and dear friend and colleague. Her name is Rosemary Jenks, one of the smartest people I know in the Washington, D.C. public policy arena. She is the Director of Government Relations for an indispensable organization, Numbers USA. She runs their government relations, which is a big part of their portfolio, needless to say, especially with respect to the immigration issue, which is its singular focus. Numbers USA does a terrific job on that, as does Rosemary Jenks. Rosemary, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you as always, Frank.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this caravan that seems to be forming up or is in some state of movement from Central America to the United States. It's a little unclear to me exactly what's going on. Do you have a read on it? And what are the implications if it does, in fact, head towards our borders?
Well, I think the first thing to take note of is that this was actually organized by a defeated left-wing Honduran politician who basically is known as a troublemaker. So he organized this caravan in Honduras, and they've moved it basically across the northern part of Honduras and then up into Guatemala so that they could pick up additional people from both Honduras and El Salvador. And now as they're going through Guatemala, they're picking up Guatemalans as well. So the reports as of late last night were that there could be up to 5,000 people involved in this caravan. It is in the central part of Guatemala at the moment, from what I understand, and moving toward the Mexican border. Apparently, there are small numbers of people who were involved in this already at the Mexican border. And by the way, the left-wing politician from Honduras who initiated this has been arrested in Guatemala for entering that country illegally, although the rest of the caravan was not arrested, obviously. The reports are now that Mexico has sent two plane loads full of federal police to the southern border of Mexico. It is unclear whether they intend to stop the caravan or give them transit visas like they have in the past. But supposedly, they're saying that they will not allow anyone to enter who does not have a passport. And most of these people do not have passports. They're relying on national identity cards. So it remains to be seen what happens when apparently the smaller groups that are already at the Mexican border are waiting for the larger group to arrive before they try to cross over. But, you know, the most important thing, and I think President Trump understands this, is that these folks cannot be allowed to step foot on U.S. soil. If they manage to do that, then it's all over. We've lost the battle.
Because there will be no limit to the number of people who will try to do precisely the same thing. And this is, of course, coming at a very momentous time in the United States, as you know so well, Rosemary Jenks, where we have an election in the closing days. We have immigration, at least in the background, if not in the foreground of this election, one of the most defining differences between Democrats who favor open borders and, well, at least some Republicans who don't. There is talk that the Mexican government, the Guatemalan government, the Honduran government, and so on are trying to stop this caravan from coming forward. I take it you're not persuaded that's the case. Is that right?
Well, the Guatemalan government certainly did not stop the caravan from coming forward because they're in Guatemala and moving up through it right now. So it remains to be seen what the Mexican government does. But remember, none of this is the timing of this is not coincidence. It is right in line with our midterm elections. But also remember that the Mexican administration is in the process of changing as well. The new president comes in on December 1st. So the outgoing president is in a bit of a bind on how to deal with this because the two administrations are not on the same page in terms of immigration.
As I recall, the incoming president, Manuel López Obrador, has actually said he considers it a human right for anyone, not just Mexicans, but anyone to migrate to the United States. And yet he's been signaling, Rosemary, as I understand it, to President Trump that he wants to work with him and he's going to be responsible and that sort of thing. What do you make of the likelihood that Mexican policies are going to exacerbate this situation with illegal immigration into the United States as AMLO, as he's called, takes power?
I think it's very possible that he will exacerbate the problem because he's also talking about giving Mexican work permits to any Central American or South American who wants to work in Mexico, which of course then gives them permission to be in Mexico and puts them that much closer to the United States. I think it's entirely possible that we will see an increase in illegal immigration. But also remember that right now we're in the final stages of negotiating the NAFTA 2.0. So Mexico really wants that agreement. You know, I think there is a chance that we will get some cooperation, at least until that agreement has been signed, and then who knows what happens.
Well, this reinforces the point that President Trump ran on in 2016 and that he has tried, at least intermittently, to advance during the first 2 years of his presidency without much help from Congress, it must be said, to put a wall in place across our border, at least in those areas where it makes sense to have a physical barrier. Rosemary Jenks, give us the latest on the prospects for such a physical barrier. Does everything really hinge on whether the Republicans retain control of the Congress, or even if they do, that's not clear. But where is this issue in the election of 2018, as you see it right now?
You know, it's very interesting because the Democrats have actually put out memos to Democrat candidates saying, don't talk about immigration, because they know that their open borders policies and abolish ICE policies and so on don't play well with the voters, even their own voters, except for a tiny fraction of the real, you know, left-wing extremists. So one of the things Republicans should be doing is calling out their Democrat opponents and saying, you know, what is your solution to the caravan? What is your solution to illegal immigration? Because they don't have a solution and they don't want to talk about it. So, you know, you've got all of these potential 2020 contenders on the Democrat side. They're not saying a word about the caravan. They're not saying a word about immigration at all. And they need to be asked. But I think it is absolutely critical for everyone to understand if Republicans lose the House in the midterm elections, we will have utter chaos on the border. We will have chaos in terms of all immigration enforcement. The president will be hamstrung like we have never seen before in terms of trying to enforce the laws on the books. Nancy Pelosi has said that one of her first priorities will be a massive amnesty. And, you know, assuming that Republicans keep the Senate, Lindsey Graham will be the Judiciary Committee chairman and is likely to make a deal on an amnesty with Nancy Pelosi. So,
Yeah, he's a more open border kind of guy in the Republican Party for sure. And this raises another question. One of the things that has been brooded, as you know, Rosemary Jenks, is even before there's a new Congress, possibly with a Democratic majority in the House or the Senate. The Senate seems less likely, but the House is a distinct possibility, I guess, that in the lame duck session, there will be an amnesty. There will be, you know, some sort of deal on the so-called deferred action on childhood arrivals or DACA program. Give us your forecast of what's in store in this regard and how important, I guess basically it comes down to this, how important is it that the voters who don't want this sort of thing to take place make their voices, make their desires known, even if nobody's talking about it at the level of the political figures, they need to be heard in the course of this election of 2018.
Yes, absolutely. And this is, you know, it is absolutely critical that Republicans do well in the midterm elections. It is critical. Now, lame ducks are always terrifying to me because it's always when the really bad stuff happens. So I think we're going, you know, I hope that President Trump will stick to what he has said, that he will not veto any bill that doesn't include funding for the wall, because the Department of Homeland Security is one of the appropriations bills they still have to pass in the lame duck. So I hope he will stick to that. He may end up having to use his first veto, because if Republicans don't do well in the elections, I don't know that they will be motivated enough to actually have the fight that they've been promising for 2 years. If they do well in the elections, I don't know that they'll have the numbers to have a strong border security bill wall funding without an amnesty attached to it. But I do think that they are much more wary of amnesty after the series of votes they had in the House on the Goodlatte bill and then the compromise massive amnesty. So I'm hoping that they will just focus the fight on border security and actually have that fight and get a bill through the House and then hopefully through the Senate, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, we need the president to stand strong on this.
You are indispensable, Rosemary, and so are the voters, so are the numbers of Americans for whom you speak. We need them to turn out in this election cycle and to make known their preferences. It'll matter not only in what happens after January, but also perhaps what happens in the lame duck session. Rosemary, thank you so much for your time today. It's so good to talk with you, and I hope we'll be able to do so again soon. Red for This, we'll speak with Rick Manning straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Rick Manning is with us. He is the director of a terrific organization, Americans for Limited Government. He has served in the George W. Bush administration, working as the senior press relations fellow at the Department of Labor. He is one of the smartest guys I know and an extraordinary asset in the conservative movement in Washington, D.C. Rick Manning, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You have been leading a fight on a matter that you understand better than most, I think in part because of your time in government as well as out. You call it Fire the Swamp. And before we get into how that might be done, I just wanted to invite you, Rick, to talk a little bit about the latest evidence of the swamp at work. Some call it the deep state. I think increasingly it's evident from the work, for example, of Project Veritas, that it's a counter state that is at work in the federal bureaucracy, the permanent government, if you will. Tell us a little bit about Project Veritas's findings, in which you participated, I believe, in some of their important recent videos.
I was fortunate enough to be invited to participate in the videos that were released by James O'Keefe at Project Veritas. And what they did was they actually had reporters get involved with the Democratic Socialists of America chapter here in D.C. And you wouldn't think there'd be such a thing. But the truth is there is a Democratic Socialists of America chapter in D.C., and that chapter is vibrant, and a lot of their members are mid to low level bureaucrats in the D.C. government or in the U.S. government. And so what they discovered was that many of these people were using their government jobs to in fact do Democrat Socialist of America work. Many of them proclaimed themselves to be communists, outright communists, and they were very proud that they were being paid by the U.S. taxpayer to, in fact, try to undermine the U.S. government.
Yeah, subvert the Trump presidency and interfere with its policymaking.
Yeah, it was astonishing. And the truth is, when you use government, the one thing that you can get fired for is doing politics on government time. And so two of the individuals who were ID'd have, in fact, either been suspended or fired from their jobs. One of them actually worked at Department of Justice. She used Department of Justice investigative tools to identify the home address of somebody who the DSA chapter went in and attacked at their home address and protested at their home address. They didn't have access to that information, but for Department of Justice materials. And so she used those materials to find that information out so that they could engage in an in-your-face action against that individual at their home.
Intimidation and the threat of violence, of course. And when you say DSA, of course, that's the Democratic Socialists of America. It is, I believe, a communist organization operating against our country, and it's got, as these videos have made clear, personnel inside the United States government and working to subvert it from within. Which brings us to your effort, Rick. You call it, I guess folks on Capitol Hill call it, the Merit Act. Tell us a little bit about it and the genesis of this initiative and what might be done about it or with it in the lame duck session.
Well, first of all, I think when I worked for the Department of Labor, one of the things that surprised me was that people who were government employees literally could do nothing, and there was nothing you could do about it. It would take a very, very long time to dislodge somebody, even if they were engaged in physical threats against their colleagues. It would take years to actually dislodge them from their jobs.
Wow. And when you say do nothing, you mean not doing their job, not performing what they're supposed to for their compensation by the taxpayer.
Correct. Yeah, they by do nothing, I mean do nothing. I won't mention any names per se, but I did have one employee who made $120,000 a year who we couldn't trust to do anything. And so she sat in her office and wrote a book while on government payroll. So it was that's your kind of what you end up with.
If you can't fire these people, that's the point, really. So talk about the Merit Act and how that would give you the authority as a senior executive in the government to fire people.
Merit Act, simple. We had the VA problem a year and a half ago, where the VA was basically letting veterans die, and the change in the Veterans Administration that the Congress made was they expedited the firing process for non-performing employees, changing and making it so you could get rid of somebody in 30 days if you needed to. So they put that in place, and we've seen an increase in firings at the VA up by 26%, and people who would otherwise just be sheltering in place and doing nothing are now, because they can be fired, are actually working. So it's had the effect it was supposed to have. We want to extend that to the entire government to make certain that you in fact can, if an employee is refusing to work, is incompetent, is lazy, or is resisting, you have a vehicle as a manager to be able to remove that employee from government service.
This sounds eminently sensible. It's just good government at work. What is the likelihood that the United States Congress in the lame duck session, hopefully, will adopt this Merit Act, Rick Manning?
It depends on the elections. If we, you know, and it's, but I know we're going to try to get it placed onto some of the funding bills as a rider on those funding bills and see if we can get the Democrats to go along. And that is the thing we're going to try to do. Now, remember, the Democrats passed the VA Accountability Whistleblower Act, which put this language into place for the Veterans Administration through a voice vote. So they didn't go and go to the wall on this before. So we're going to try to get that process done. We're building momentum on it. Over 100 conservative groups and leaders signed a letter urging Congress to take this action. And we're building momentum. And the key players you guys need to know, Senator David Perdue from Georgia and Barry Loudermilk, Representative Barry Loudermilk from Georgia, are the ones who are pushing the ball on this and are the heroes on the Hill.
Terrific. Well, needless to say, I was one of those who signed that letter, I believe, and this is a very, very important initiative, I think, to all of us who care about not just the Trump presidency, but frankly, any president who might find himself defied or herself defied by permanent bureaucracies who are staffed by people who do not agree with the will of the people as expressed in their elections. Speaking of which, Rick, you mentioned the Department of Justice a moment ago. I did want to ask you very quickly, you were as pleased as I was about the Senate finally giving its consent to the nomination of two key people for senior positions in the Department of Justice. Just tell us a word about Eric Dryband and Jeff Bossert Clark and the jobs that they will now be able to do for our country.
It's somewhat incredible. Thank you, Frank, for bringing this up. This is important. It's somewhat incredible that the Trump administration, almost 2 years into the Trump administration, doesn't have some of its top officials at the Justice Department in place and never has. So the Obama administration has been running the Office of Civil Rights, which is one of the most powerful offices in justice because they're the ones who go in and enforce the election laws. They're the ones who declare companies out of bounds in terms of civil rights violations.
And give Sharia supremacists a lot of running room for their agenda as well.
Yes, indeed. And for over a year, President Trump has had a nominee, and we've been trying to get him through. And finally, he is now taking office.
That's Eric Dryband, I believe, right?
That's Eric Dryband, correct. And it's very important to be able to sort of put Trump's fingerprints on this so we can direct that agency to positive things rather than trying to continue pushing the Obama agenda through that office. The other one that's significant is at the office in the DOJ, that handles all environmental filings. When we lost Scott Pruitt at EPA, we lost somebody who had the real legal background to fight battles on the environmental end. It made it extremely important that we had the DOJ really heavily involved in that game to be able to take on the cases that the EPA needed to be taken on to try to drive Trump's environmental policy. Finally, once again, we have somebody who is from the Trump administration running that department and making those decisions.
I just wanted to say, Rick, thank you for your work in these areas, as well as, of course, in the general effort to improve the quality as well as shrink the size of government. Rick, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.